bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all of the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III, Jean Rappel, Ben Clark.
What?
Did I skip something?
Yeah, you skipped me.
Oh.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme and who will be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
Sorry.
Obviously, someone doesn't want me in the podcast anymore.
No, I couldn't do
this
without
you. I can take your subtle hints.
Couldn't do this without you.
Yeah, it'd be very weird doing it without me. You just talking to yourself and then pretending to be me. And oh, that'd be funny, though.
We haven't done a part two in a while, so it's a bit weird. I guess we just jump straight into it.
Yes.
Yes. So let us now
commence.
Actually, we should do like a little recap, shouldn't we?
Yes. Okay. So who are we talking about?
So we're talking about Charles V again. Eliza, can you remember the main things that happened in Charles V's life?
100-year war. Taxes, yeah. But he's like, I'm going to change that to make it more effective for the people and not have them ride against me. Navarre's just going around creating chaos wherever he goes. They get the Spanish as allies. The Pope is back and forth for where he wants to go. Oh my gosh, where will I live? Who knows? Oh, let's be an anti-Pope. And then the English are just like, we were doing so well, but now we're not, and we're just, bleh. And then
everyone dies.
He dies. Yeah.
Everyone dies.
Everyone dies.
Charles dies. Edward dies. Black Prince dies. Pope dies.
Right hand man dies.
Lots of people die.
I think that was an excellent summary on my part.
It was pretty good, actually, to be honest. I know. Why did we have all of that other episode? Oh, you also missed out. Geclin, the masterful general guy.
Yeah, I said Charles. Right hand man.
Plucks out of nowhere. Yes, right hand man. So let's get into Enchanté, and I've got a few images to show you of King Charles V.
Enchanté.
Okay, so here is a 19th century portrait of Charles V. I forgot his number for a second.
A Charles.
By Guillaume Saint-Evre, which is an artist we've seen before, but this may be his finest work.
Ooh.
His portrait of Charles.
Very official. Oh my god, that is so... Oh, the beard. Moustache.
Describe this man.
Oh my god, he's got this little funny little pointed beard. Hilarious. Got very, he's like side profile, he's got the crown. Some nice jewels on it, I have to say. He's got luscious locks. He's like... I like his garment. It's like a shawl almost. On top of the fur.
It's ermine.
On top of... Yeah, fur. But it's like a shawl.
An ermine shawl.
Yeah, basically.
Like on top of his fleur-de-lis cloak.
Yeah, but he doesn't look like... He doesn't look sickly, like...
No. This is like, very much at odds with all of the physical descriptions of Charles that we have.
Maybe they're just not showing his body, which might have been very frail, but his face...
They're definitely showing his good side of this... Yeah. Extremely flattering portrait.
It really is. Someone really favoured him when they were having to paint. They were like, we're going to give him the best interpretation ever.
He is hot stuff.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to show you his tomb effigy.
Okay.
Which is this.
I'm guessing not as hot stuff. Oh, no, actually not that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except for the wrinkly forehead. Other than that, pretty good.
He's just a regular looking dude in this, pretty much. Yeah, I've also got
some locks. Okay, in this tomb, though, where the black hole is for the crown, was there originally like a gem there, you think?
Yeah, probably.
Plucked out.
Maybe they plucked it out in the revolution or something.
Probably.
I've also got a pair of statues of both Charles and his wife, Joan of Bourbon.
That's how it looks.
Yeah.
They're very nice. Aww, like a cute little old couple. Or middle-aged.
Yes. They're not that. They shouldn't be that old because they died in their 40s.
I think they've aged them up a tiny bit here, like 10 years, but still looks pretty good. And he's holding a little church, a little cathedral church.
And now I'll just...
And she has a book. Oh, I like that depiction.
So those are the statues. Hair. And then we've got a few manuscript depictions. I'll just send them all at once.
Okay, so some sickly thing is holding a book.
A guy's holding a book for Charles to read, showing that he is like a scholarly, intellectual. But
the guy's like naked except for some like chastity belt and beads.
No, he's not naked. He just has a very tight shirt on.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
He's got buttons going all the way up.
Okay, it really looks weirdly more like a chastity belt with, like, just this weird penis.
I think the colour is a bit faded here.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Because I was going, why are they saying naked? What? What kick Charles into?
Anyway, so Guy is holding a book for Charles to read. We've also got a typical coronation depiction where Charles does not look super happy about being
and
the king.
And he's got, like, a stick with a hand on it. Oh my god, that's like his poking stick. When he wants to get someone's attention.
We've seen the poking stick before in previous portraits.
Yeah, but this one's just really noticeable.
Yeah.
I can imagine him poking be like, you, hey you, over here, come on. Get out of that.
Follow the stick. No, he uses the stick to move the pieces on the chessboard. Uses the hand stick.
Yeah.
Because his arms are too frail and weak and diseased. And then the third image is quite special. It's a, hang on, I'll pull out the details.
A feast that went well.
It's a feast that went well. It's a contemporary depiction of Charles hosting a banquet for his uncle, Emperor Charles VI.
There's a boat.
From a manuscript that was commissioned and published during
Charles' reign. There's a little wee boat.
There's a little boat.
With some flags on them.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think what?
I don't really know why the boat is there. Just at the feast.
Why not?
But why not?
Maybe it was like a parade float.
I think it's showing like people visiting or whatever. But it's got it's actually got the flag of Flanders on the end of it. The black line.
Okay, no. We're going to say it was a parade, like, stage thing that they had going on where they were watching it because there's the little tower and people. And I'm going to pretend that they were doing a play.
Yeah, they're doing a little play where there's a boat and a tower and it's all happening right in front of this feast with these three
it's
kings
for entertainment.
Standing there. Yeah, entertaining.
Who's the third king?
I don't know. I wasn't able to figure it out. I don't think it's Navarre because I think Navarre... Oh, it could be Navarre,
I don't think it's
actually.
England.
It could be Navarre because at this point Navarre is just a bit pacified. But the guy in the red is the emperor.
Okay.
The guy in the blue is obviously the king of France. Yeah. But yeah, this is Emperor Charles the
Fourth. Oh my god, even their dishes are like shaped like little boats.
Yeah. I love. And Emperor Charles the Fourth,
really
he's
into the theme.
He's the son of John the Blind, so he's Charles V's uncle.
Yeah, uncle. Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Family
so
connection.
They're quite closely related. And Charles IV has at this point just become emperor. So it's good times between France and the Empire. I also have another depiction, not of Charles, but of the building that he is typically most associated with.
I guess that's the one that he's holding?
No. Which is the Louvre. So this is a depiction of the Louvre. It was technically painted in the 15th century, so 100 years, less than 100 years later. But this is the Louvre as Charles renovated it during his reign. He made it more opulent and splendid and more of a residence than just a fortress.
Place. Loads of turrets and towers.
It's very fancy looking.
It is. And then it's got the people working.
This image, for those who want to look it up, it's from the Book of Hours of the Duke of Berry, who is Charles's son. It's called Les Très Riches Heures.
Oh, it even has the little star signs.
Yeah, the top is like a calendary thing. The middle is the Louvre with the battlements around it. And the bottom is like some peasants working in the field outside the Louvre. It's a very magnificent building. It reminds you a bit of like the castles of King Ludwig, which was inspired by 14th century French architecture.
Yeah.
So we are in like peak Disney castle period. And a lot of this is because of Charles V, who definitely stands out in the records as like a builder king who made a lot of architectural reforms. Now, let's get more into Charles himself.
Yes.
So he's often characterized as the complete opposite of his father, John II, who is often depicted as like this like robust warlike king. And while King John certainly had a bold and boisterous character, there is definitely more similarity between the two than would first appear. So both of them had a bit of a sickliness that stopped them from living beyond their 40s. And both of them were sort of bookish. Although while John was busy reading like chivalric romances, his son Charles was reading about like law and like political science and how to taxes govern. And how to govern. Yeah. So,
like 101, how to govern effectively.
So as a result, Charles's epithet, he's known as Charles le Sage or Charles the Wise.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Could also mean Charles the Erudite or like Charles the Well-Read.
I like that. Which
I think is a very perfect epithet. Fits really into a T. Because Charles, lacking any physical strength or extraordinary charisma, made up for his
brains.
Yeah, had to rely solely on his brains. And it turns out he had a big brain. So it was good.
I'd say he must have had a level of charisma to get those peasants to stop attacking when they barged into his chambers.
I mean, they weren't ever going to hit the Dauphin. So
one of them could have got it's debatable.
Well,
come on, if he'd been a like complete, like, you know, ass about it and was really rude to them, one of them could have lost their temper easily and in a fit of rage.
We also actually know quite a bit about Charles V's personal life and character, thanks to a sympathetic biography of him, written by none other than Christine de Pizan. You know who Christine de Pizan is?
Yeah, I actually did a cross stitch of her.
She's very significant. So in 1404, she published the Book of Deeds and Good Morals of the Wise King Charles V, which is the ninth of her 18 books. To give a bit of background on Christine, she's a big deal. She was originally from Venice, but she came to France as a young girl when her father was hired by King Charles V as his astrologer. Christine ends up marrying a French nobleman and having children, but all the while she forges a career as a court writer and becomes a favorite of the French royal family. So she starts out just writing romances, but expands into histories and then full-on philosophical tracts, the most famous of which is the Book of the City of Ladies, which is considered a kind of proto-feminist text, and which we will certainly get to at some point. Like, it's definitely, there's definitely going to be a Patreon episode about Christine de Pizan.
Oh, yay, because I actually know about her because my cross-stitch, when I was choosing historical women to cross-stitch,
she was on. Like, if Dante gets an episode, Christine certainly gets an episode.
Yes, and they're both Italians.
Well, Christine's really French, but... Because she was essentially raised at the French court. She didn't spend much time in Italy. She was essentially just born there. Although I was listening to an audiobook recently, which is like set during her period, and they give her an Italian accent. And I'm like, she wouldn't have an Italian accent, but whatever. So Christine's last book is The Song to Joan of Arc, which is published in 1428. So that's about 60 years from now. So Christine lives quite a long time as well. So her book about Charles V is actually published 24 years after his death. And it's mainly her looking like nostalgically back at his reign and portraying him as the ideal example of a king. So she's got rose-tinted glasses a bit.
Definitely.
But it's still a really incredible source because Christine, for once, actually seems to care about the king as a human.
Yeah, not just as a figure.
She's also the first confirmed female chronicler we've ever had, which is very exciting.
Nice. Didn't we have one for the Arabic side, though?
A chronicler?
Oh, that might have just been a writer.
We've had women as, like, writers, as, like, troubadours and stuff. Oh,
okay, that's what I'm
probably thinking, is that. Yeah, but not as, like, people who documented the reigns of kings, basically.
Okay.
So in terms of how she depicts Charles V, Christine depicts him as a very friendly and generous guy who sort of carries out the rituals of royalty with sort of the grace and patience and reverence that they deserve and sort of keeps the court as this like elegant, extravagant place. But at the same time, he has like this personal touch and he's not afraid to like smile and joke with his servants as he goes through the motions.
I suppose you want to keep your servants happy because you don't want them to side with the enemy and poison you.
Yeah. So from Christine's perspective, he's got like the grandeur and the piety, but he's also got the common touch as well.
Yeah, which is what a king should have.
Yeah. But once again, we obviously have to treat Christine with a bit of a grain of salt because she definitely has an agenda. Which is like she's portraying Charles as the perfect king as like an example to princes in her time who, let's just say, aren't behaving very well. So yeah, just keep that in mind. But that being said, she certainly hands down a favorable image to us of Charles V.
Yeah, and she could have chosen any king, really.
Yeah, and in Argenté, we're all about the superficial image as well.
Yes.
So with that being said, what do we want to rate Charles V for Argenté? I think it's quite good.
Yeah, I think it's quite good. I'm very impressed with him. It kind of shows you don't need to have, like, battle depictions to be a good king. To be
like there are, I mean, there are depictions of the battles in Charles's reign. Yeah. But he's not involved in any of it.
Yeah.
It's all Guesclin. Yeah. That would be Guesclin's Argenté.
But he was the one who pointed him, so.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like a 7 or 8.
So John II, last king, got a 6 and a 7. He was quite, he had quite a leg up from being the first king with a proper portrait from the period. Which we once again don't have for Charles V. But we will get for Charles VI. And all of the kings after him. So this is the last king for whom we don't have a contemporary portrait.
Okay.
We do have contemporary portrayals of him.
Hmm.
But they're not like, you know, drawn from life. Drawn. They're just like a standard king image.
Yeah.
Which we've seen before.
Okay. What are you thinking?
Because of his building, I think that like puts him up a bit. I'd go like an 8.
I'm thinking 7.5.
I think that's a perfectly respectable score.
Thank you. Like, how you give me a little positive, say. I'm like, oh, okay.
So that is a 15.5 for Enchanté. Now let's move on to En Garde.
Yes.
En Garde.
Charles V is considered to be the most successful king of France to rule during the Hundred Years' War.
Well, he did expand the territory back.
Yeah, arguably except for the one who rules at the end of the Hundred Years' War, but that kind of, I don't really count that. So he's arguably... he's arguably the most competent guy to sit on the throne since the Iron King, Philip IV.
Nice.
His one major downfall was his poor health, which prevented him from traveling and prevented him from living long enough to see his son, Charles VI, reach adulthood. Although, if you know anything about Charles VI,
not his fault.
Him reaching adulthood probably wouldn't have helped. France after Charles V will fall into an uncertain period of regency, and it's unclear as to how much we should blame him for that.
Yeah, you can't blame someone on their health. Like, his health wasn't something that, like, you know, he went out and stood in the cold kind of thing. Like, it wasn't a health, like, saying where you're like, oh, he totally caused that himself onto himself.
But yeah, for a guy with such severe health issues, Charles V did amazingly well.
I know, really well.
And actually, we'll get into it in Beyond Throne, but, you know, lasted longer than, you know, you might think. We'll be right back after this.
The commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
It's kind of interesting, like some people might have that, like, thought where they go, oh, imagine if he had been healthy, how, like, even better he would have been. But I'm like, if he was healthy, potentially he could have not been better because since he was sickly, he spent all his time, like, you know, training his brain. But if he'd been healthy, he might not have done that. So he might not actually have been as good of a king.
If he'd been healthy, he might have been John.
Yeah, we don't know.
John II.
Bloody France would have
not done in England.
And then probably France would have fallen into England's hands.
Who knows? So as we know, Charles's first glimpse of power was in his regency, which definitely had its ups and downs.
Yeah, well, he was still a teenager.
Yeah, but Charles basically just managed to survive, which is the best you can hope for at that stage.
He did well. He survived it.
Yeah, he managed to survive the uprisings of Etienne Marcel and the Jacquerie.
Bloody Navarre banding him.
The civil unrest did mean he was in a very weak position to face the English and lost so much money and land in the Treaty of Brittany. But we did blame John for that because none of it would have happened if he hadn't got captured. Also, Charles V spent the entire rest of his career making up for Brittany.
And if you think about it, he got back, he paid off those debts, like, you know.
He paid off those debts. He re-expanded the French territory. France actually ends up
in a better state
in
by his death
in the end of Charles V's reign than it was at the start of John II's reign. So yeah, he, just to briefly once again summarize, he hit the ground running in his reign with decisive moves against Navarre, which ended up in Navarre getting totally neutralized as a threat. He replenished France's finances with sweeping tax reforms. He made the French army less expensive as well. So we relied on smaller, cheaper armies with good commanders rather than big, expensive, flashy armies with crap commanders, which has been the case before now. He outsourced his military efforts of less high-ranking but competent commanders like Bertrand du Guesclin and Jean de Vienne. And in doing so, Charles completely reversed the failures of his father so that by the end of his reign, France is winning.
Not as much nepotism going on there.
Yeah, that helps. And all of this, once again, I have to stress, which I stressed last episode, Charles has done all of this without setting foot on the battlefield. Probably he's doing all of this with his little chessboard in the Louvre.
In the little side chamber by the throne room.
He doesn't stay in one room. He does move around. He has several palaces in and around Paris. But he's mostly just staying in that area.
Each of them have a little chest room.
Yeah. Guesclin is like, the way that he just like suddenly rises out of nowhere kind of reminds me of Joan of Arc. Because he just sort of appears and then he like turns France's fortunes around very suddenly and then he's out. It's kind of funny.
Peace out.
Also, the favouring of Guesclin is not the same as other royal favourites that we've seen.
Yeah, I know, like, people aren't upset about it.
And the reason is that Guesclin is actually successful.
Yeah, so, that helps. He's in greedy. So
Charles has picked Guesclin for his actual skill and his, like, competence. And
not
his, like,
for
merit.
His personality.
Yeah, not just because he likes the cut of his jib or because they're, like, lovers or whatever. Often the reason that a favorite is elevated has nothing to do with the favorite's ability to be, like, a co-ruler.
It's like how good they are at sweet talking.
Exactly. Guesclin ends up going down in history as like an almost Arthurian figure.
Yeah.
That's why he's called like the black dog of Broceliande. He's like emerged from, and him being a Breton, which is where a lot of the Arthurian myths are based, kind of helps with this kind of vibe of like this this strange Celtic man who emerged from the woods.
To save us all.
To save us all.
And then disappears once he's done his job.
I mean, he just died, but he didn't disappear, but he died. But you know, same diff.
Give it some myth.
Yeah. And also something that I hinted at as well. Charles V improved the defences of France, especially Paris itself. Yeah. In particular, he expanded the Louvre and made it more of a permanent royal residence. It was, after all, a bit more secure than the Palais de la Cité, where the king had been stormed by the angry mob.
And literally beat you after that, like he literally put that quite high up on the to-do list. He was like, okay, I must improve where I live, so I don't have this happen again.
He runs into the Louvre. He, like, shuts himself in the Louvre, and then he's like, this could use some redecorating.
Bring me the blueprints!
So he completely redecorates the Louvre. So he employs an architect named Raymond du Temple to turn the Louvre from just a fortress to be used in emergencies into a more permanent royal residence that he could actually feel at home in. And the Louvre will henceforth become the center of the Valois court and government for the rest of the Valois period.
Wow.
And to learn more about that, you can check out Gary Giraud's free audiobook about the history of the Louvre. I will mention a couple of highlights of the Louvre renovations that you will enjoy, Eliza. The circular tower at the very, very center is the royal treasury.
Ah, smart.
That's where all the money goes. Put it in the middle.
Hardest place to get to.
Charles also has lots of secret passages in the Louvre.
Oh, yay! I love a secret passage.
Historian Michael Brower says they were probably used not by like servants to run around behind the scenes, but by the king himself.
Oh my god, he just pops up!
Yeah. he likes to move around secretly and like escape the public eye because he's the king. He's obviously
he just likes listening in on the goss.
Maybe he listened in on the goss as well.
That's how he's able to tell who he should pick as as good advisors based on what people are saying about that person. And he's like, oh, this person keeps getting mentioned a lot as a good guy. Maybe I'll choose him.
We had this with Philip IV as well, but I love a sneaky king. It's just it's the most fabulous thing.
I can just like imagining him like popping out of nowhere and then people just like, oh God, where did you come from? And he's like, I've been here the whole time. Or have I?
So yeah, King Charles could easily like pop away if he was like getting a bit bored of a banquet and he could escape in a secret passage and then he could end up in like the library, which
probably
the best part of the Louvre from our perspective was that Charles commissioned a massive library to house his 12,000 manuscripts that he owned.
Nice!
So...
that survived.
he had this massive royal library. A lot of them do survive. They're just, you know, a bit scattered these days.
Yeah, but I wish the room...
Oh, the room, yeah. The sense
of the room would have been nice.
Yeah, well, it's now the Louvre Museum, which is a bit a bit of a newer script structure. So one of the most important texts that Charles compiled was his continuation of the Grande Chronique, the Grande Chronique de France, the Grand Chronicle, which contains a number of those depictions of the King of England swearing homage to the King of France that we have shown in previous episodes. So his books were important as a sort of propaganda tool, which brings us back into En Garde, to the king promoting his own power and that sort of thing. So now going back to defences, Charles also reinforces the city walls of Paris.
Nice.
Also reinforces the other great fortress that defends the city, the Bastille.
Ah.
So he's really like making an effort to centralise the rule around Paris.
Mm. Yeah.
As we've mentioned, he's not a keen traveller. due to his chronic illness, so he wants everything coming to him. Mm. And outside of Paris, Charles makes sure that the royal domain has control over the frontiers. So he takes control of some important castles on the edges of his territory, and he also makes sure that castles that are not being used or that he doesn't have enough people to man are being demolished so that the English can't come in and use them. Or the routiers as well, the bands of wandering mercenaries who sometimes take up residence in a castle and then like terrorize the surrounding countryside. So he's stopping that from happening by demolishing castles that aren't being used anymore.
Smart.
As well demolishing as building.
They're just sitting there wasting away.
Yes. So he's building, but he's also demolishing as the need arises.
Bet you he's probably reusing some of that material he's demolishing too for his new buildings.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Being environmentally friendly.
I mean, they were all about recycling in medieval times because they because it was easier.
That's limited.
It was easier back then. It's so easy for us to just chuck things away now, but back then it was harder to just get rid of.
Also hard to get a new thing of it.
Exactly. Like, it's really cool. Like, in a lot of medieval buildings, you find like Roman carvings and stuff because they've just reused the stone. It's kind of cool. One last thing he does for the defense of the kingdom. Charles makes sure that every able-bodied peasant gets trained in archery.
Oh, that is so smart.
Which is something that the English have been doing. They don't have longbows, it's still just crossbows, but...
better than nothing.
The good thing about crossbows is you don't need a lot of skill to use it.
True. Well.
Yeah.
As long as you load it up.
So that's En Garde. It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really good.
He really turns it around.
He really does. I'm liking the building. Like how the, like, the Louvre, like, you know, and the, like, building the Bastille. It's pretty cool.
Like, obviously, he doesn't build the Bastille. He improves the Bastille. Oh. The Bastille's already existed for a while. I can't remember who built the Bastille, but...
I'm gonna
but yeah, it was pathetic, and he leaves it. He leaves it nicer.
I'm gonna Google who built the Bastille.
That's my job.
Yeah, but I want to know now.
Oh no, he did build the Bastille. Assuming that Google is correct, but from the thing I read said he improved the Bastille.
Maybe it was like you know how like Versailles was originally a hunting lodge. Maybe it was like that.
It was originally like just a tower, and then he...
Yeah.
He
it wasn't like even a tower, it was like a little hut.
That's very possible, yeah.
yeah.
Let us know, listener, if you know.
Yeah. Was there a hut before?
So what do we want to give Charlie Boy for En Garde? Definitely better than John II.
What did we give him?
A 3 and a 3.5.
Oh, yeah, he's getting way above that. Oh, way above that.
So Philip the Sixth got a 6 from each of us, which is interestingly high. I can't remember why he got that. I guess he held out for a while. He held out pretty well.
Yeah, not in that. I like it that he got the peasants trained. Like, that's always good in case, like, you know, you're really super desperate and you don't have any soldiers. And they can also defend themselves, which also helps. So that's going to get a few points of that, because that's good military strategy there. Even if he did borrow it from the English, still, he can pump it to that,
yeah,
which is good.
He's relying a lot more on, like, the town militias and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Rather than just the expensive knights.
Yeah, which is good. I like that how he's, like, prioritizing, like effectiveness, but not being stingy.
Yeah. He's smart still spending saving. He's still spending money on, like, making sure, yeah, the court is extravagant enough, because you need to display that wealth in order to show,
yeah,
your
make
power
people happy.
To, yeah.
Make the nobles happy. Distract them from things. And then I do like how he's like, you know, the building of, you know, making Paris more centralized and having the buildings and the wall and the fortifications more nice. That's good.
Yeah.
I like how he's getting back some of that land. Basically having common, having like two areas. Be like, please, sir, can we come back to the French fold?
Yeah.
That's nice. I'm thinking like a 7.
7?
Yeah, 7.
I was thinking higher. Mm. I was thinking like an 8.
Maybe I do 7.5.
Because it's hard to give him like a 9 because there's, yeah, no great like a military victory that he, yeah, himself is involved,
yeah, he's
in.
Just good at him choosing those people.
But everything in En Garde that's non-military, he does.
Oh, like, and the Navy. They actually had a decent Navy for once. That's a good
the
thing.
The decent Navy for once. That's like half a point.
It really is. Okay, I'm going to go 7.5.
7.5 again?
Hopefully. Yeah, that's pretty
nice. So he wants it again, doing a 7.5 and an 8.
Yes.
I don't know. I might go 8.5. For me, it's like just short of a 9.
Because
a 9 is like you got to have that great battle. True. But I think I'd do 8.5.
Oh, maybe I'll go to 8. He does it well considering his, like, the things that he, like, you know, within his limits. Like, he knows he can't go do it himself, but he's good at trying to improve it or getting other people to do it that do it well.
Okay, so you're coming up to 8 now. Nice.
Yeah, you've convinced me.
Okay, so we've edged ourselves up to a 16.5 for En Garde, which is pretty good. Nice. Now on to Voulez-vous?
I think I'd want to live under him.
So because this is part two and we've got a bit of extra time, I can go into a bit of detail here. So Christine de Pizan, Charles's biographer, gives us a day in the life of Charles.
Yes.
And this is a translation from Charity Canon Willard. When he had been combed, dressed, and outfitted according to the demands of the day's program, his chaplain, a distinguished person and honorable priest, brought him his breviary, which is like his prayer book, and helped him to say his hours according to the canonical day of the calendar. Around 8 o'clock, he would go to Mass, which was celebrated each day with glorious, solemn singing. As he came out of the chapel, all sorts of people, rich and poor, ladies or maidens, widows or others who had problems, could make their petitions to him, and he very kindly would pause to listen to their supplications, responding charitably to those that were reasonable or piteous. More doubtful cases he turned over to some master of requests to examine. After this, on appointed days, he would meet with his council, and then with some nobleman of his own blood or some clergyman who happened to be present. If some particular lengthy business did not prevent him, he would go to the table around 10 o'clock. His meal was not long, for he did not favour elaborate food, saying that such food bothered his stomach and disturbed his memory. He drank clear and simple wine, light in colour, well cut, and not much quantity nor great variety. Like David, to rejoice his spirits, he listened willingly at the end of his meal to stringed instruments playing the sweetest possible music. There one might find several kinds of foreign ambassadors, noblemen and knights, of whom there was often such a crowd, both foreign and from his own realm, that one could scarcely turn around. There he received news from all sorts of places, perhaps incidents and details of his wars or the battles of others, and all such matters. There he arranged what should be done according to what was proposed to him, or promised to solve some matter in council, forbade what was unreasonable, accorded favours, signed letters with his own hand, gave reasonable gifts, promised vacant offices, or answered reasonable requests. He occupied himself with such details as these for perhaps 2 hours, after which he withdrew and retired to rest for about an hour. After this rest period, he spent a time with his most intimate companions in pleasant diversions. Perhaps looking at his jewels or other treasures, he took the recreation so the excessive demands on him would not damage his health, because of his delicate constitution, in view of the fact that he spent most of his time busy with demanding affairs. Then he went to Vespers, after which, if it was summertime, he sometimes went into the gardens, where, if he was in his Hôtel de Saint-Paul, sometimes the Queen would join him with their children. Aww. There he spoke with the women of the court, asking news of their children. Sometimes Aww. He received curious gifts from various places, perhaps artillery or other armaments from a variety of other kings, or merchants who would come bringing velvet, cloth of gold, and all sorts of beautiful exotic objects or jewels, which he had them show to the connoisseurs of such things among members of his family. In winter, especially, he often occupied himself by having read aloud to him 5 stories from the Holy Scriptures, or the deeds of the Romans, or wise sayings of the philosophers, or other such matters, until the hour of supper, where he took his place rather early for a high meal. After this, he spent a short period in recreation with his barons and knights, before retiring to rest.
Hmm.
That is a day in the life of King Charles V.
You know, I have to say, when she was saying his, like, little afternoon activity of, like, looking at his jewels, I was, like, imagining a little dragon.
I was imagining John from the Robin Hood movie being like, taxes, beautiful taxes. It's nice to have this little day in the life. Now, Christine is writing in part to be like, this is how the ideal King's Day should be.
Yeah.
But you can see the little touches in there of like stuff that's particular to Charles, like the fact that he had poor health. He had to look after himself.
Yeah. Or that he would talk to the ladies of the court, inquire about their children. I thought that was very sweet.
Yeah, that was very sweet. And this is all from Christine recollecting from her childhood.
Yeah.
What the court was like.
Sure, some of it might have been a bit fuzzy, but some of those bits would have been true.
Yeah. So throughout this, I'm like imagining like a little Christine like running around.
Yeah.
Seeing all this happening. So despite being at peace with England through much of Charles V's reign, it didn't necessarily feel that way in France thanks to the bands of routiers that are still roving around the country. So taking us out of court, out into the countryside, it's not necessarily the best time to be alive. Though by the end of his reign, Charles did manage to sort of direct the routiers' attention to stuff like the war in Spain or to attempts at crusades. At one point, there's an attempt to go on crusade into Hungary, which fails miserably. But at least Charles is like flinging them out. Yeah. So Charles's time as the Dauphin Regent was definitely not the best time to be alive. But it taught him from an early age that a good king rules with consensus.
Takes into the account the people.
So he doesn't give in to Etienne Marcel's demands to have, like, a permanent voice for the urban bourgeoisie in, like, government. So they don't go quite that far, but he nonetheless refrains from policies that are too unpopular with the masses. And in doing so, he turns public opinion gradually towards him and away from Navarre, who's the one commanding the opposition.
Did they abandon him?
Yeah.
He tried to fix taxes, didn't he? Like, try to make them not just brutal.
Charles, yeah, he was pretty determined to make the taxes more regular and consistent and less like a sudden extortion that would just happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, kind of like what we have today, like a little bit each, rather than like a whole giant amount, which would cripple people.
Yeah. So the worst of the taxes that had been begun around like the 1340s, so like at the beginning of the war, was called the fouage, or the half tax, which is exactly what it sounds like. Houses were taxed per fireplace.
That's like how England had the windows tax.
It's a lot like the windows tax, yeah. But this tax was really unpopular. And Charles
Everyone needs a fireplace.
Charles did continue the tax in various parts of his reign in various parts of France. But on his deathbed, he ordered it to be repealed because he knew that it was terrible.
He was like, it's a stupid tax.
Yeah. Although I guess it is a good way to keep track of how many households you're taxing, is to like count the fireplaces. But also, if you have a fireplace in medieval France, you're probably bourgeois. You're probably not a peasant living in a ditch. Like,
true.
So yeah, Charles also shows concern for his people during the English chevauchées in his territory. So for example, John of Gaunt's chevauchée through Picardy in 1373. Geclan's tactic was not to confront the English in battle and to just let them tuck themselves out, which worked. But Charles, knowing what a freely rampaging English army would do to his people, made a concerted effort to organize the evacuation of farms and villages and get as many people as possible into fortified towns and castles.
Well, that's really good.
Couldn't attack as much. So yeah, Charles is ordering that to happen.
That is good.
So while the French army is avoiding the English army, they're also following Charles' orders and making sure that the people are safe.
Yeah, that is good.
Yeah. So I also mentioned Charles V's library. This wasn't just like a hoard of knowledge that he just sat on.
Dragon.
The library in the Louvre was open for, at least for like the educated
upper classes. Yeah, you could read.
If you could read, which was fairly rare.
Only the upper classes, really.
But, exactly, yeah. But Charles sort of encouraged his counselors to read and learn from his books. He also made a concerted effort to compile books in French rather than Latin or Greek.
Oh, that's really good.
So that more people could read them.
Oh, I'm liking that.
Yeah. But yeah, the last kind of negative point I have is the Black Death is still happening.
We can't control that.
Yeah, you can't control that. The third wave occurs in 1373, and it forces the king to flee from Paris, which becomes like decimated by the plague. And there's also a lot of harsh winters that cause famine throughout the country in the 1370s, which inflates the cost of grain. Again, not his fault. Although he did kind of make things worse by declaring war on England, but once again, that is kind of a thing that he needed to do. Otherwise, he'd be a pushover. And he actually succeeded in getting the land back from England.
True.
Yeah, so that's Valivu.
Okay.
Those are all the things that he does. Literally all the things that he does, because we just went through his entire day in the life.
I would probably want to live under him. Like he's one of the kings that I'd be like, yeah, if I'm going to live under a king, like out of the kings he's done so far, I'm leaning towards him. Like he does seem to care about the people.
Which is, the main thing you want, Valivu.
Yeah, which some kings definitely don't do.
And there's been a lot of kings so far who have, like, maybe there's, like, stories about them caring about the people, but it hasn't actually shown in, like, their actual policy.
Yeah.
Whereas with Charles, you can really see, like, a tangible effort to make people's lives better.
Like, it's quite high, I feel. Like.
Yeah.
Like, I would... Like, sure, there's the war going on, but even when the war's going on, he's still trying to help the people by, like, you know, evacuating them into the cities. He's still trying to save lives. And, like, even the Black Death, that was not his fault. Like, you know, can't control that.
So what would you give him?
I think like an 8 or a 9.
Ooh, an 8. Yeah, or a 9. Wow. Eight. That is great reform territory.
I know.
I think, so the last king to get a high score in Voulez-Vous was Philip the IV. Mm-hmm. But he was like, not necessarily the best guy to live under. This guy's actually, he's doing the great reforms that Philip the IV is doing, but he's...
You'd want to live under
him. Nice. He's also nice while he's doing it. Yeah, I would like, I'm tempted to even do like an 8.5, which is Blanche of Castile's Voulez-Vous score. Because he's also got all the cultural stuff.
True, and he's flourishing trying to get people to read.
Art and literature, getting people to read.
Architecture.
He basically transforms Paris to make it the Paris that will be iconic for the next like 300 years.
Still iconic to me.
But it's in its 14th century form for the next 300 years or so.
True.
Like, this is the Louvre that Catherine de' Medici will live in.
Yes.
I am happy to split the difference if we go 8 and 8.5.
Okay.
Unless you want to give the more generous score. For once.
Okay, I'll do the 8.5.
Okay.
I do like him. He does seem pretty lucky.
And then I'll do an 8.
Okay,
so we've negotiated that trade-off. so that is a 16.5 for Voulez-Vous, which is the same as what he got for En Garde.
Nice.
Yeah. So now moving on to Ooh La La.
Mm-hmm. Ooh La La.
Now, you might not think he's a scandalous guy. Because he seems like a bit of a goody two-shoes. But there is a bit of scandal, particularly in his love life. So the early years of Charles's marriage, like, so back when he's a teenager, are a bit fraught because Charles is infatuated with a noble woman called Biette de Castanelle. Biette is also married. It's rumored that her son, Jean de Montagu, as well as a potential other son, is Charles's son that he fathered when he was a teenager. Gosh. I know, very scandalous.
That is. Even whispers of that.
It's not known whether this is the case. True. I've seen a lot of back and forth with historians being like, yes, he was the
but come on,
son. No,
the
he wasn't.
Whispers to stick around, though. Like, yeah. We're still debating it. To have that.
It's unclear whether it was recognized at the time because Jean de Montagu, spoiler alert, ends up getting executed. And in his execution, calls him the son of King Charles. But it might be like a... the whatever the handwritten version of a typo is. So it might just be like an writing. Error. Yeah, it might be an error that makes it look like it's saying that he's the son of King Charles. But it's unclear.
Still's been infatuated with a married woman.
Yeah. But then the plot thickens. Because Joan of Bourbon, his wife, herself may have been unfaithful. Yeah, to Charles. So there were rumors, once again, abounding, that she was romantically involved with a poet called Hippolyte de Saint-Alphonse. And that when she had a daughter in 1366, it was actually his daughter, not the king's. Although the child didn't survive infancy, so it's kind of a moot point.
Yeah.
And Joan was never prosecuted for infidelity. Oh, okay. But yeah, Joan was a bit of a loose cannon in some ways. Possibly thanks to generations of inbreeding, Joan of Bourbon was not the most healthy or mentally stable person. So around 1372, shortly after the birth of her sixth child and second son, Louis of Orléans, she suffered some kind of mental breakdown. I don't have a lot of details about what this breakdown entailed or like what really it was, but it's very possible that Joan's mental illness was genetic and that she passed it on to
her son.
Charles the Sixth, her son, who listeners who know will know that Charles the Sixth ends up being called Charles the Mad. So nonetheless, Joan seems to have recovered after a year of this whatever mental illness this was. She recovers from this bout of psychosis or whatever. Because in 1373 the king saw her as being like healthy enough to make her the designated regent. She didn't think
to
him.
Okay.
So that shows that he'd regained some trust in her.
Yeah.
However, this was not to be because Charles outlived his wife by 2 years. So yeah, on the 6th of February, 1378, just after turning 40, Joan died due to complications in childbirth.
Oh, it's always the case.
Yes. And Froissart tells us that she died because she'd had a bath when her physician told her not to. Well, this is probably not the case. It's probably just a good old case of childbed fever, as it was known at the time, which was very, very common and be very preventable today. It's basically like caused by some kind of like infection in that area, which could be caused by something as simple as like the physician not washing their hands.
Which,
or like maybe like a bit of placenta getting stuck or something like that. So it's very sad. Charles, by the end of his marriage, to bring it back to Ulala, was a faithful, loving husband. As we saw in that quote from Christine, he's like clearly like a family man who's very...
I guess once he got married, he settled down.
He settled down. He was not a teenager anymore. Well, he was already married when he was like 12. Yeah, but he still had like a bit of like wild teen years, and then he settled down, basically.
Yeah, once the bubs came about.
Yeah, they didn't have children until quite a few years into their marriage, and by the time they were having children, they seemed to get along pretty well, and they had lots of children, which we'll get into in the next round.
Yeah.
Also, Charles doesn't seem to consider remarriage at all after Joan dies as well. So that's a nice little bit of faithfulness. But that's really kind of all I've got for Ulala. There are various tangential things that he's kind of like semi-involved with, like the papal schism or like
Spain,
the Spanish stuff with like the brother murdering his brother. But it's not stuff, directly. None of it is stuff that he's directly involved in.
Yeah. I feel as like, I can't really give anything for his wife. Because, like, you know, it's his wife, it's not him. It wasn't like he drove her to insanity or anything. So you can't be like, oh, it's his fault.
Yeah, Charles basically had a fling when he was a teenager, which, like, haven't we all? And that's
it. With a married woman who has two children. That might be mine.
Yeah, and there's not too much in the way of, like, skullduggery, I suppose.
Yeah.
Unless you can think of anything.
No, I can't. I'm thinking, like, maybe I'm going to give him, like, a point for the whole potential affair. And maybe half a point for a potential children. Bastard babies.
It's very hard to give Ulala points for stuff that happened to him or near him or around him.
Yeah. Yeah, but with, like, that, I'm like, if there's still, like, people discussing it to this day, even if it's just arguing whether it's true or not, for it to continue to live to this long, to still be remembered, I think that's something in of itself. That's why I'm thinking a point and a half for the potential children. Okay. Yeah.
I think I'll just give 1 point. I think I'm going to be harsh. So that is a 2.5 for Ulala. Now moving on to Lovey on Throne.
Lovey on Throne.
So his reign. So he reigned from the 8th of April, 1364, to the 16th of September, 1380. So that is 16 years, 5 months, and 8 days, which is 3.07 points. Could be higher.
Oh, well. He did a lot during that time, though. I'm guessing we're not including when he was Dauphin, so.
No, we're not. Unfortunately. So then children. So with his wife, Joan of Bourbon, Charles V had firstly Joan, who died at the age of 3. Then Bon, named after his mother, who died at the age of 2. Then he had another Joan, who died at 6 months old. And then he had Charles VI, our next king. Who obviously outlives him, so that's number one.
Yeah.
Then he had Marie, who died aged 7.
Aww.
Then he had Louis, who once again survives into adulthood, and he becomes the Duke of Orléans after the last Duke of Orléans dies without children. Then we have Isabella, who dies age 4. And then we have John, who we don't know how old he was when he died, but it was young, so he also doesn't count. And then finally, we've got the third child that actually counts, which is Catherine.
Is she the one from the childbirth?
She is the one from the childbirth.
Wow, she survived. Usually both die.
Well, Catherine is quite sickly and she dies at the age of 10. But she does outlive her parents. So
yeah,
that is sadly only 3 out of 9 surviving children.
Wow.
Yeah, it's only the older 2 sons that actually live into adulthood. And yeah, all the daughters die young, which is crazy. Aww. So as you can see, the Valois, you know, they're fertile metals, but they're not producing a lot of
surviving
strong children.
I was trying to think of something that would rhyme with surviving Stanleys.
They're not surviving Stanleys. And both Joan and Charles were quite sickly and already quite inbred, and they were second cousins. So it's like,
no wonder.
It's not genetically the best idea to do any of this.
Cool.
And so that is 3 children, which is 5.07 points. So
let's hope they're not as like deformed looking as the Habsburgs.
I don't think they're as bad as the Habsburgs at all, but they're not great.
Yeah.
So that's a total V on throne score if we add up the reign and the children of 8.14 points, which is a fairly middling V on throne score.
Yeah. Okay.
Now for the final score.
Da-da-ling.
Da-da-ling. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
59.1.
Not too bad. Not too bad
at all.
Over 50. Yeah.
It's nowhere near as good as Philip the Fourth, Charlemagne, and Philip the Second, who are currently our tippity-top scorers.
Still pretty good.
And it's not up in the 70s the way we had it with at the high point of the Capetian dynasty. 100 Years War really brings him down. But he fought, and he gets back to the surface of where France should be, basically.
True.
Which is honestly the most you can ask for at this point.
It's true. True.
So with that being said,
The ultimate question,
is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough to be released from our dungeon, to go through the Battle Royale Championship, and to be spared the guillotine?
I want to spare him. Yeah. I find him very interesting. I want him to go through.
Oh, that's great. I agree.
Since I've had one where I've been like, oh, I definitely want him.
I don't know. I didn't know when I was doing the research. I was like, I don't know if we should definitely, but I think the vibe this whole episode has been like, he's a winner, and he's an unlikely winner, he's an underdog, which is you want to root for.
We always love, I know, and us Aussies, we love an underdog.
Yeah.
They're like our favorite thing.
He's going to be in the tournament. Everyone else is going to be on their like horses, like ready to joust. And he's just going to be like, would you like a game of chess?
No, he's going to be like, mechanical horse. They're on their real horses. And he's like, mechanical horse. He's like, boom, I can build my own horse.
Oh, he's like Iron Man. He's like, he's like lost his heart. So he's made himself a new heart. And like, he's got like this, his ulcerous arm has fallen off. He's built himself like a robot arm.
Yeah.
And he's Robo King.
Yeah, he's Robo King.
Robo King. Because he's a genius and he can do that.
Yeah, just imagine him, like, literally, he would have been, like, everyone else had, like, a real horse. And he's like, I made my own horse since that tip. So they had a little escalator for him just to get up in so that way he didn't have to hoist himself up onto the horse. It just went like, whew. And he'd slide right into the seat of the metal horse.
So that is the life, reign, and rating of
a Robo King.
Robo King, Charles the Wise, as he is usually called.
But now Robo King.
next episode, we're going to be doing Charles the Sixth.
Woo! Woo-hoo.
Who is definitely what not Robo King.
But he's
more like, he's more like Loco King.
Oh, don't you now.
Although, also known as Charles the Beloved as well. So yes. He may have some good points to him, like his father. But yeah, he has three regents at the start of his reign, his three uncles, and also a couple of regents at the end. So there's going to be a lot of regencies to sort out. And all of these people's lives overlap a lot.
Yeah.
So if I did an episode on all of them, they get real repetitive. And on top of that, we're also doing a Joan of Arc episode. So, you know, it's exciting times. But I have basically the rest of the summer to figure out what we're doing for Charles. Because we're going to have a wee little break. Because I've got a holiday in July. Eliza's got a holiday in September.
And August.
And also my parents are coming to Edinburgh in August. And I'll be working like crazy in August. So, you know, we'll be busy doing that.
We won't be gone forever.
If you feel starved of Battle Royale content, you can always sign up to the Patreon as well.
Yes.
Got lots of extra bonus stuff on there. And we'll hopefully, if we get time over the summer, be releasing more bonus episodes.
Yes.
Like, I'm thinking we could maybe watch The Last Duel, if you want to do that, Eliza. Because it is set during the reign of Charles VI. And let us know if you have any recommendations that are not Joan of Arc stuff yet. We'll get to that stuff. And we'll get to Christine de Pizan as well. But she lives a long time, so her life would be riddled with spoilers if we did her before Charles VI.
Gotta wait.
But let us know if you want to do something, if you want us to do something that's just outside of that. It's like, also vaguely French related or not French related at all, because we recently did Sharjah Aldera's episode, and she has very little to do with France. We really only did her because she captured Louis the Ninth, but apart from that, it was all Egyptian history. Yes. So that was exciting. Maybe we could do a Tutmosis the Second episode, and you can be the role of researcher for that. Maybe do a role swap. Huh. How would you feel about that?
Always do that. Or do maybe I'd explore more Japan and do something like that, since it's where
maybe
I am.
I'd be down for that as well.
Yeah, because I feel as though people know about Egypt, but not as many people know about Japanese history.
Yeah,
but it's equally as fascinating.
And it would be a break for me because I wouldn't have to do any work. That'd be great. That'd be refreshing. Yeah.
Let us know if you guys want me to do something about Japan, maybe about the eight empresses of Japan.
I would love to just show up with an episode for once and have no notes and just vibe.
Okay, well, if the people agree to it, then that might be achieved.
That would be the Christmas in July present that I would want.
So guys, if you want to make Ben happy, then approve of that.
Yeah. Just let us know, what episode would make you sign up for our Patreon. Yeah, let us know that.
Would make you chuffed.
Riddle us that. Because we could make it happen, potentially. So with that said, follow us on the socials, etc.
Yes.
And that is going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.